This must be the most illogical statement that has ever come into the minds of thinking people, that nothing produces something, or that profound intricate designs are self-generating, or come into existence by self-causation. This is a pure assumption, which is contrary to their whole manner of living. I said that in philosophy, if you make false assumptions, you can build any kind of a logical structure, and you will never defeat philosophy by showing it to be illogical. You'll defeat philosophy by showing it to be foolish. With this foolish assumption, they build huge structures on self-generating designs, which they never practice in their daily life. We have a very practical statement coming in Hebrews 3:4. Every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Whoever believes that a beautiful house or building is self-generating, whoever believes that a storm came through, swept down some masses of trees, and suddenly a precise and exact building emerged. This is never practiced in daily life. So we could go through the various experiences of life. And every single person, regardless of his theory, practices common sense in his daily living. It's only when he comes to his great speculations that he becomes ridiculous. Here we have this developing by the assumption of Darwin. And I'm sure that Darwin didn't realize what would develop from his speculation. And so here was the assumption of self-generation, that profound intricate designs originate themselves. Oh my, how utterly absurd is such a thing. It is far more simple to believe that there is a reason back of all existences. And that as we think of the unimaginable situation in which we find ourselves, it takes a lot less faith to believe in a creator and benefactor than it does to believe in a self-generation principle. And so we have the assumption in the Bible that the evidence for God is in what we see. And we have two very important passages concentrating on this among many others. You have Psalm 19:1, for example. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and the firmament is declaring the work of His hand. This is a very elaborate Hebrew structure here. One of our professors has said, and he indicated that nothing stronger could be put in words than this. So he said, the heavens are declaring to their utmost, or are actively engaged in proclaiming the glory of God. Here's an intensive verb, he says, indicating that we understand the basic things about God by what is observed. You have the conclusion of Romans chapter 1 in verse 20. Since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Can you conceive of the meaning of these two words, without excuse? So as soon as we see something orderly, something precise, immediately we say there has got to be a reason for it. And we are impressed by what we see. We may not sit down and analyze it 1, 2, 3 as to why we are impressed. But every single moral being is impressed. Just think of this tremendous arrangement in which we find ourselves. We try to amass the impressions under a threefold area. We try first of all to look at our own internal being in self-consciousness. And so we have our inner personalities and abilities are profound to contemplate. You have the psalmist referring to this wonderful creation that he was conscious of. He considers man a remarkable being. What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visited him? Here is man with his tremendous abilities. We have our consciousness of our abilities, do we not? The ability to think, the ability to reason, the ability to view facts and draw conclusions. We can imagine what is not actually before us in the physical. What a wonderful thing that is, to picture in our mind what is before us. We have the ability to remember what has occurred. We are able to evaluate our lives in conscience. We have a spiritual consciousness of ourselves and of the existence of God. Think of how wonderful is our endowment here. These wonderful abilities of the mind and of our God consciousness, that we have this remarkable ability of experience. And we realize that we have reactions to what we think about. We experience pleasure and pain. We have evaluation. We're able to worship. We're able to appreciate one another. All of these characteristics flow from the area of experience. As we indicated, the experience is always based upon what we think about and what we perceive. As we recognize one another and we have this recognition of God, then we are also conscious of the matter of directive, a free will in our personality, a self-determining ability as to what we're going to do. And this is most remarkable. We'll talk a little further about this. It's so important to perceive this and to realize that we do have the ability to originate our actions. And then we observe that our personality is an integral whole, that we do not function as a separate group of parts, but rather we are an integral personality, a complete unit. And truly, we are wonderful in our internal discovery. How did we have this ability? And we're conscious that we are above the body, aren't we? And so this is universally assumed, that we are wonderful personalities in our being. The next area we want to look at briefly is our body. And what a tremendous arrangement this is. Just imagine. I know so little of the body I've been living with, and there's so much to be learned. And think of the specialist. There's so much to our wonderful bodies that the general doctor practitioner is rather on the decline. And now we have specialists who concentrate on one area of the body. This is how wonderful we are. And the psalmist expressed this, didn't he? 139:14, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. So think of our bodies as delicate, complicated machines, exactly adapted to our personal endowment. Think of the abilities we have to communicate with others through our five senses. Now we want to look at our bodies a little further. Think of the remarkable characteristics we have here. Oh, let's just imagine now this great assembly of mysterious unit here. Here are bodies. What are they worth? Just a few dollars as far as the substances are concerned. How can we conceive that such wonderful assemblies could be brought into existence with such utter cheap material? Only a few dollars, then, are involved. And the record says that God formed man out of the dust of the ground. And just think of the miracle this was. God spoke all these millions and millions of elements into their relationship. How can you conceive that this kind of a thing would simply happen, in other words? So here we have the material. Think of the skeleton we have as to the backbone and structure. We're supposed to have 214 bones, as usually reckoned. And the backbone is supposed to have about 33 vertebrae. in all its flexible joints, all lubricated and designed, you see. Just imagine this design. My, as we poor engineers tried to design some particular structure and work into it lubrication. We, in our corporation, we had quite a group and a very important laboratory who were doing nothing but studying lubrication of our various mechanisms. And here God has brought into existence all these joints and all these flexible units and the lubrication of them. And this whole arrangement, why it just becomes utterly unthinkable that such tremendous arrangements could ever be designed. Now we're supposed to have about 400 muscles. They're mostly in pairs. And they are supplied with energy of the blood. We have all the way from the tiny muscle of the eye, this tiny little thing which can blink the eye in about a tenth of a second, up to the large muscles in the back and so forth. Think of this structure, all designed in beautiful harmony. And think of the interpretation of the brain, for example, and the wonderful structures that we have here. Think of the tissues and how God has combined and provided substance to our bodies, and the millions and millions of cells that go to make up our bodies. Think of the assembly here. And they tell us that our bodies are continually changing. And so the body you have today is not the same as the body you had about 7 years ago. There's a continual replacement arrangement. We not only have a beautiful, complicated arrangement, but a means of replacing them and keeping the cells in activity. Now think of this mysterious thing. Think of the skin and the outside covering. And think of the pores and the perceptions and all the millions of elements that go in here. How could you conceive that this would all simply emerge by happenstance of some kind? How can you imagine such a thing? And then can you conceive the headquarters of all operations, the brain and the head? As you realize, the poor hands can't do anything. Our bodies can't have any interpretation in themselves. They're merely the vehicle in which the brain interprets. And every single experience of our whole body is connected up to the headquarters, which is our brain. We have all these unthinkable linkages in the nervous system and its unthinkable design. How can you even begin to think of such a design as this? And imagine that all of this, you see, would happen of its own self. My, how the mind is mystified in its profound appreciation of the wonderful things God has given us to observe. And think of the complicated nervous system then, with all its network, its miles and miles of linkages. And here we have messages going back and forth with unthinkable speed. And so the mind has to interpret everything that is going on in the whole personality. My, how can you conceive of such design as this? You get to the eye. My, oh my. We don't appreciate our eyes till we have trouble with them. And so we have a remarkable, remarkable structure. And how do you ever put together such an arrangement of this? Here are two little cameras, if you please. Automatic focus arrangement. And we have a unity of these two eyes. Of course you don't see with your eyes. They are merely the means of interpretation. You see with your brain through your eyes, of course. The poor eyes can't see anything. They're just a means of the interpretation of the brain. And how the brain interprets sight, nobody has any idea of. And will you please tell me, how do you pack a million elements in a single eye? There's supposed to be over a million elements packed in one little eye we have. And we have all these connecting linkages to the brain. And how do you make all these linkages in connection to the brain? And how does the brain use the eye to see anything? And what is its interpretation and so forth? And how do you have this lubrication provided in the eye, and also a filtering arrangement and a protection arrangement, all designed, you see, all thought into? My, oh my, we just get so happy as we think of the greatness of our God, you see. And how you have the light-sensitive element, and no one has ever understood why color is perceived by the eye. And what is this mechanism, you see?
Isn't it amazing, my friends, that people can spend their whole lives investigating something and not allow themselves to worship? They have to admit there's more to see than they see. And yet they try to imagine all this is self-developed. Why wouldn't they humble themselves in utter worship? This makes me so happy. Why, I got a wonderful God. I got a complicated God. He has abilities, unthinkable abilities, to do what man can't conceive of. I'm awfully glad that I've submitted myself to a God like this. You see, he's on the intelligence side. He's on the designing side. He speaks things of existence to complicate man. And you know, God is doing many of these things, I think, for two reasons. The first thing God does so many wonderful things because he just simply is wonderful. And a constructive personality wants to do things with ability. If a lazy person doesn't want to use his ability to do anything. And so when we talk about wisdom, we're going to see that wisdom is a combination of love and knowledge and ability. In other words, love harnesses ability to do something worthwhile. And this is what we'll see wisdom to be. And so God is doing all these remarkable things because he's so capable of doing these remarkable things. Then he's done these remarkable things to confound man, to make man unsolvable in all his internal separation as he tried to imagine himself a separated unit in himself. You see, God is trying to make it hard for the unbeliever. The way to transgress is hard. Unbeliever is anti-believer. It's easy to believe. It's hard to unbelieve. You see, as we see all these unthinkable assemblies, how do you picture this eye, for example, and all its millions of linkages? I wouldn't have the least idea. One fellow has counted 137 million seeing elements in the eye. Or calculated this in this little tiny area of the retina here with this very hardly a square inch of surface. And all this is packed into this little section. And how do you harmonize these two with all its automatic focusing? You know, you can study the analysis of men. And they're trying to pattern their design after God's mysterious creation on every hand. And they're trying to spend millions of dollars trying to analyze what God has spoken into existence. Oh, I think it's remarkable. We have the ear, for example. What is sound? And how are you going to raise to pick up sound? You have here, you have an opening, don't you? A phone here, you have a drum, you have a hammer, anvil, stirrup, and so forth. And these all vibrate with sound. And how does the brain pick up sound, for example? What is loud, for example, and what isn't? How do you distinguish all these mysterious things? Of course, the poor ear can't hear anything. Again, it's all connected to this integral linkage of the brain and the mind. Oh, how we see the remarkable things. We look at our other head arrangements here. You have the nose with its breathing and its filtering system and so forth. And what is taste, by the way? How do you create a taster? And how do you arrange this? And then, of course, the tongue again can't taste. It has to connect up to the brain. And the brain does the interpretation as to what's going on. Now we're going to see the goodness of God here. We have to eat to live, don't we? God didn't want this to be monotonous, so much of a chore of duty. So he did two things. He created a taster that could interpret things. Then he created things to the taster for to enjoy, you see. This shows design, doesn't it? It shows kindness, shows goodness of God. You see, before we think for an hour or two on a thing like this, we get awful happy that we're on the Lord's side. And we begin to say, like Paul, if God be for us, who can be against us, you see? If our God is so great as this, then what does it matter? The little opposition we have in our pursuit of things. And what are you going to say about the whole breathing arrangement, the chest and the lungs? And here we have these 20 to 25 respirations a minute. And here we have a mysterious mechanism that's a chemical activity. It picks out the oxygen out of the atmosphere and assembles what we need for the furtherance of our bodily structure. How do you design a lung system to pick up the oxygen and remove it out of the atmosphere? My, how we see God's development. And what about the heart? Is it, it keeps on in activity? Someone has said it takes 45 seconds for the heart to circulate oxygen throughout the whole body. Isn't that a challenging thing? Shall we fill our lungs with poison then, so that our bodies may be filled with poison? Here's God's remarkable design in this tremendous arrangement that He's made. What are you going to say about this heart that pumps away these 72 times per minute with its great unceasing activity? It's an automatic pump, and my, what research has been in this area, and millions of dollars are being spent trying to design mechanical hearts to replace the heart that God has created. And my, how natural is this functioning mechanism, which is valves and which is self-propagating energy? What makes this interesting instrument keep right on going? What's the energy back of it? Nobody knows. It just keeps on going. And think of the work it does. Someone has said that if you should assemble all the work that the heart does in an ordinary lifetime, you have enough foot-pounds of energy to lift the largest battleship of the American Navy right out of the water. So much work does our heart keep right up during our lifetime of activity. Think of the energy pursuing and pumping and working away at this mysterious circulation. What do you think about the blood, for example? Supposed to have about 25 million red corpuscles in it, picking up the oxygen and carrying it through the various circulatory spheres. And think of the connecting linkages throughout our whole body. And think of the circulation that's going on. Then we're supposed to have about 35,000 million white corpuscles. And they're picking up the impurities, the things that our cells cannot use. And they're rejecting those so we can have a constructive, self-energized matter of existence. My, as we think of this mechanism, this wonderful situation, how could that ever come to exist? And how are you going to interpret the digestive system? What is this long passageway that passes through our bodies? And the food goes through it and is treated with different chemicals. And the certain fluids are designed and brought in contact with the food, different parts of the passageway. And they were so intimately united in our personality that when we live in emotional upset, some of these fluids don't enter into our digestive system, so we do not digest our food. And into all kinds of complications in our stomach and in the situation of our whole life. Just think of the intricacy of God's design. That there should be these remarkable things that God has created. And how does it, the food, move along in our digestive system? What about these automatic muscles and all these functions? We're a complete, wonderful design. And I never heard of anybody proposing additions to our wonderful design. I hear of every hand trying to analyze the reasons for the various segments of our design. And think of the digestive in all the situations that come to our consideration. And what are you going to say about the privilege of having offspring? Here, I think, is the time of greatest difficulty for the unbeliever. Here we have the privilege of bringing new units of life into the world with all its millions of elements all assembled there. And as we parents look at the beautiful, beautiful child with all its elements and its responsiveness, my, oh, my, my, what a miracle is before our eyes. I remember a professed atheist from India, a highly educated mathematician in our engineering department. And when he came in to tell us that they had been blessed by a beautiful boy, you could see that his atheism was at its lowest ebb, and he was having the greatest of difficulty in trying to imagine how all these remarkable things could just happen and have no meaning. And how do you take little elements of life which you can't see and incorporate physical identities, internal and moral identities? How do you incorporate all these unthinkable elements right into the tiny specks of existence that you can't even see. Scholars in medical science are trying to get into the study of genes, and they get real mysterious. And here you have microscopic genes, they say, which you can't hardly see under the most powerful microscope. And these are assembling to do some of these remarkable conveyance. How do you convey not only physical characteristics, but also internal personality characteristics, and so on, through elements like this? Does anyone have any answer for anything like this? You see, if you can answer this, you don't have to worship. But if you can answer it, the only intelligent thing to do is to worship. And I can't begin to have any solution for these unthinkable miracles that are surrounding us. Therefore, this to me is a vehicle of total humiliation before such a great God, who has allowed me to live and discover these wonderful things. Remember I said yesterday, you cannot have a greater concept of yourself than you're willing to conform to. Man can't think he's such a wonderful being and go out and abuse his life. You say, are there absolutes of moral character and moral respectability? Certainly they are. How can you think of our wonderful creation and think they're not absolute? What did God do? Design all these wonderful things for us to go out and abuse them worse than many animals? I'm sure that many animals wouldn't want to believe in evolution if they could understand what's going on. They'd be ashamed of so-called evolution. And yet man is fool enough to try to believe in this. We have many remarkable characteristics in animal creation, don't we? Oh my, I get so humble before God as I begin to dwell on some of these mysteries. It just makes me so worshipful, so thankful that we can be simple submission to such a great God like this. Don't you feel yourself happy in submission as we think of some of these wonderful things? We go into the next great area, our surroundings. And my, what can we ever say about this? We have the great universe before. No one's ever discovered the extent of it. No one's ever been satisfied that there wasn't a greater extent. You have this big 200-inch telescope in California, which is supposed to pick up perception 1,000 million light years away. 1 light year is the distance light travels during a period of a year, which is about 6 million months. So this 200-inch telescope is supposed to perceive 1,000 million times 6 million miles in distance. Does this make you happy to trust in a God like this? Do you think we ought to be excited about staying in this little called the world? We have to look at things from God's angle. God must wonder why we're so excited to stay here when He's so great. He can make a world for each one of us. That's how great He is. You see, we just want to be happy we're on the inside. Then we can look at these wonderful things of our God and be so grateful and so worshipful. Think of the expanse. Think of the galaxies or groups and masses of bodies. Think of the arrangement why one star is supposed to be so big that you can take the full orbit of the Earth, 93 million miles approximately, around the sun and put the whole business right inside the surface of a star. My, just think of the immensity of our God. You think He's able to help us in our situation? Do you think we should have faith in a God like this? Should this help us in prayer? Jesus said if you have faith, if you can believe in your heart, things can happen. Now, things we need to believe God for right here in our present situation in His school. Are we able to believe God for something? If God is so great, then don't you think He can move into our situation, whatever it is? Remember, Jesus said the reach out of prayer is to believe that you did receive it before you do. Using a past tense here. This is this mystery of faith which is not self-generated. It is a responsive thing toward God that is true. But this faith comes as we perceive the greatness of our God. And so faith cometh by hearing, Romans 10:13. And the word hearing is a report, word report. So faith is built up as we consider the report concerning God. This is how faith grows. What is the limit of this faith? There is no limit to this faith. Are you satisfied with your prayer life? Are you satisfied with your achievement? Oh, as we think of the greatness of our God. And here we have our own little solar system, which is a small thing in God's great universe. And we feel that the earth is immensely important in God's whole scheme of things. How can we conceive of what is going on here? My, just imagine. As I mentioned, who can conceive that you and I would ever live to see pictures of our Earth going around its orbit? It's some 92,900,000 miles in radius. Here we are going around in regulation about 18 miles a second. Is our movement in this orbit. How can you conceive of it? Right out in space, with no linkages of any kind, with absolute precision, so that astronomers would get all excited if they have a discrepancy of a second in a century. Shouldn't this lead somebody to submit to God? God must not only be a God of greatness, He must be a God of precision. How can you be careless and be a Christian and associated with a God like this? He's a precise being. So everything we think about God leads us in the direction of achievement, doesn't it? And constructiveness. Just imagine a situation like this. Who can conceive of such imagination? And so here we have a 24-hour rotation, don't we? And we're going about 1,000 miles an hour on the surface. Who can imagine the centrifugal force of this tremendous rotation here that's going around? And just think of the centrifugal force of such rotation. What keeps us from going away from the Earth? A very mysterious thing that nobody's ever worked on and figured it out. This matter of gravity. What is the pull of gravity? What causes it to exist? If it didn't exist, we'd all fly out into space. Lives here upon the surface would be no more. What is this matter of gravity, you see? Who put it there? Why is it the same? Does this tell us that God is an happenstance personality who is not dependable? You see how as we begin to think of all that we had to observe, my, how thankful we can become of the greatness of our God. Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my. And think of the regulations. Think of the characteristics. It seems hard to believe this, but you realize that time is a very important research element. And here in Paris, we have the headquarters of the world time. And every country has its highly educated scientific experts working on this matter of time. And they're regulating things. They've got such a thing as an atomic clock now. And I couldn't even begin to fathom what 1,000 cycles a second would be like. But this thing is supposed to have 9 billion cycles per second. In its flux, in its beat. And it's supposed to be accurate 1 second in 20,000 years. Wouldn't have any concept. as the element of time. What does this tell us about God? That God is some happenstance being that you can't depend upon? That he just does things carelessly? Does this give us the idea of God's carelessness? And every once in a while, they have to add a second or deduct a second from our yearly calendar because time is not accurate enough to determine what's going on. So here we have the great precision of God. What happens here, you see? How does all this exist? What kind of intelligence do you think it is to say all of this is just happening? And here we are sending out heavenly bodies to other planets in our solar system. And they're going off for months and months in the future. And we have our computers calculating where these different bodies are going to be. Why, there's certain cycles that happen every nearly 100 years. And they expect them to happen in the next 100 years. They're making plans for it. Why doesn't somebody see the operations of God? That God is a precise being. How can they keep on in all these analytical studies and not be humbled before such a great God as this, you see? And we can be glad we're on the Lord's side. He's our God, you see. Doesn't make much difference how long we stay here. If we have faith, we're on an eternal concept, not some little fluttering emotional thing. We have a God we're happy with. May it never be said that we wish we didn't have to submit to a God like this, that we actually think the gratification of the world is better than our relation to God. Oh, how it bothers me to hear such things as that. Things of the world better than associating and thinking about the great God? You see, unless along with the increase of your faith, you can't have it. Isn't this sorrowful? You can't have the expanse of your concept of God unless you're ready to aim your life higher, can you? If you want to shoot low, you've got to have a low concept of existence of some kind. But now we're getting a high concept of existence. And I'm sure we all feel the drawing power of this high concept of existence in the great being of God. Oh, how sweet and how lovely to think of the being and existence of God and His great operation. My, how many things we can think about here. And here you have such simple things as the atmosphere. And here we have the life breath for creatures. A specific ratio, don't we, of nitrogen and oxygen. Think of these proportions, about 78% nitrogen. About 21% oxygen, and here's a design, isn't it? In other words, God designed a breathing arrangement for us. He designed an atmosphere to be breathed. He put all this together, you see. Design, harmony. And here's a remarkable thing, my friend. It's amazing that this has only been discovered about 250 years or so. Here was this Joseph Priestley, a clergyman here in England. A practical scientist, and he was experimenting with some mice here one time. And he put them in a closed jar, and they began to lose their energy of life after a certain short period of time. So he just tried something. He put a plant in with these mice, and he noticed that they were vigorous and kept right on living in vigor. Isn't this amazing? How does this happen? Well, here's another design. The plants pick up what we don't want and give us what we want. Supposing that was reversed. So we give off carbon dioxide. This is what the plant picks up. And the leaves of the plant are a chemical factory. Picking up the carbon dioxide that we don't want and giving off oxygen, which we do want. Does this look like a careless thing on the part of God? So lo and behold, Joseph Priestley discovered this remarkable thing. Here again, we have design, don't we? Supposing the whole plant life wanted the same thing we do. This is why when you get into a forest and you breathe deeply, you feel invigorated with oxygen, don't you? Design. You see, God's thought, don't you love a God like this who's thoughtful and wise and intelligent? Really, it's not happy to be careless. Where did the idea come from? Let's work as as short a time as we have to, and retire as soon as we can to do nothing. Just as though it's going to be happy to do nothing. God never designed us to do nothing, you see. God is not a being who's doing nothing. Because to be constructive is the outflow of personality. And we're only satisfied in our life when we're being constructive. Isn't it wonderful to think of God? Wonderful, wonderful features in this great area. My, just think of animal life. And think of the plant life that exists. Who can imagine what's in a sea? Isn't this interesting? I'm going to have a time of worship again. As some of our roses come up, I took off the cones and fertilized them a little bit and dug up around. My dear wife, when she was home, appreciated them so much. All right, here are some stems, and there's the black dirt. And I expect that there'll be the same kind of flowers they were before. And pretty soon there will be a nice growth. It'll have a specific spacing between leaves and all of this. And pretty soon there'll be a lovely little bud. And that little bud is going to explode and will have a lovely color arrangement. And every petal will have a similarity. And there'll be a beautiful arrangement. How did this all happen? Can you design a flower, for example? Can you build a structure like this? One time I was lecturing a certain place, and this long church had a whole row of interesting bushes, and I walked along there and worshiped God. I saw, well, now there's six petals to all these flowers. I don't see any fives. I don't see any sevens. That's interesting, isn't it? And how does this little plant know enough to grow a bush and grow flowers with six petals on it? Then I look in the inner projection, and there's six little projections in the midst of each petal. And I had myself a good time with the Lord. I said, now that's interesting, blessed Lord. I couldn't begin to produce anything like this. I can't even understand how this can happen. And I'm sure that God made all this for two reasons, I said, because He's an interesting being. That's the first thing. And then He wanted to make life interesting for us who are His children and wanted to make life difficult for those who would rebel against Him. So we have all these interesting things. And how does a little seed get energy? A little seed that can be raised in the crevice of a rock. And here comes the freezing elements and splits this rock. The little seed begins to challenge the rock. And the rock doesn't have any fear that it can be disturbed. But the little seed has something in it that grows and goes. And it can go up to its crevice and have such energy to split the rock. Here was a little tiny seed. How'd that happen? What is the mysterious thing about a little seed? Can you produce something like this? Over here in England, there were excavations. And they discovered that here was some ground that wasn't covered for about 400 years. And when these excavations were turned over here, some new plants coming up that nobody had ever seen. Isn't this amazing? Here's some little mysterious thing called a seed that has something called life in it. There it is hiding all these long times. And when the facilities of growth come into existence, up it comes. It has within us an amazing thing. How do you put these interesting things in a situation like this, you see? Over here in Japan, there were 4,000 years, apparently, that certain seeds have been buried. They studied the surrounding earth and structure there, and they made this decision. And here come some plants that have had this mystery. What is the mystery of life in a little old seed? Isn't this amazing? As it splits itself and up comes the structure. Isn't God a wonderful being as we look through the whole area of this? And my, as we emerge out into the animal life, how much we could say about this. And here we have the unending instincts of the creatures. We have some who are designed to live in certain situations. Others live in other situations. And they're all adaptive. And to our amazement, they seem to have a satisfaction of life in their sphere. It seems like only man is restless in his life. Because, of course, he's not living according to his design. That's why he's restless. But here we have all these amazing instincts surrounding us. And how do you put all this together? Who can understand this? And so our biologists are spending their life trying to understand instincts of the creature. And they just simply can't find the solution of some of these remarkable things. My, the bird sphere of study is so intensive, as you realize. They're catching these creatures in all parts of the world. They're branding them, and they're recording their capture and so forth, and then releasing them. And when others find them and can find them again, there are these communications and all these interesting things. What is it that it allows these creatures to do these remarkable things? Take the nest structure. I'm told that no two birds build exactly the same kind of nest. What causes this? Isn't this a diversity? And so you have in Acer there, the weaver bird, a most interesting creature. And this weaver bird creates the most strange nest. It's suspended here from a limb. It has a long, it has a round section down here. And it has the entranceway from the bottom. And the bird goes up into this area. And here we have the nest all structured around. And some biologists thought they would study how the weaver bird gets this understanding to build a strange nest like this. You have to have certain kind of materials to make this thing hold together. You have to have certain weaving abilities and so on. It just doesn't set on a surface. It's suspended and has to hold the holes held together. So they captured the whole mass of these weaver birds and raised them in seclusion for five generations. They never saw the nest of their parents. They had no concept of environment here as far as what was going to happen. Then after five generations, they released these weaver birds again. And what do you think they do? They go about gathering specific materials that will build a nest like this. They go to weaving this integral structure to enter from the bottom just like their parents did. They never saw a nest. They never learned anything by seeing what was going on. How do you incorporate this, you see? How do you put in the very mysterious this egg here, a little source of life which has an instinct in it? How do you put an instinct like this? And this will grow into a bird in short order. And the bird moves out of this situation and begins to experience a new manner of life and goes about its business. How does it know what to do? You see, can you design something like this? Can you put instincts like this? I didn't read that these biologists were converted to dogs. They should have been, certainly. They should have been challenged that they can't duplicate this. And they should have been challenged as to the greatness of our dog. How do you have account for the transmigration of birds, for example? You have birds who are hatching out way up here in the Arctic Circle, don't you? You have the hummingbird and the Arctic tern. This is a very interesting creature, about 15 inches long, a very vigorous bird. And I understand that it'll hatch out, and in about 6 weeks old, it's ready to make a 10,000-mile trip all the way down to the South Pole. And how does it do this? And they capture these birds at both ends of the line. And they know that this thing is going on. And then these creatures will stay down there for their summer and then return the 10,000 miles back to the same place they came from. Will you please tell me, how do they know such distances to traverse? And how do they know to come back to the same area and the same nest? I don't see how this is possible, but biologists have studied the Arctic tern and they find out they're swimming, they're flying across the ocean, if you please. And so some Arctic tern come down the east coast here, and then they fly clear across the ocean and go down the coast of Africa to the southern tip there. And so then they come back again. How do they know what to do, you see? You see, God is confounding people on every hand by unthinkable mystery that nobody can understand. And these researchers are writing their big papers and they're trying to study all these things that are going on. And God must have a kind of a smile sometimes when he thinks how hard man works to understand him and just won't submit to his love. And he decided to live his life without God, you see. You don't have to be bad to have a true gesture here. Sometimes truth is very amusing, isn't it? And when man thinks he's going to rebel against God, it is amusing to God in a certain sense. For example, the psalmist says that God shall laugh them to scorn. Now, you can't blame God for this. Because here we have this little planet called the Earth. And we have some little tiny creatures lifting their fists against God. They're defying God. They think they're going to overthrow God. And God, they don't have any concept of the greatness of God, of course. And God does.
So God comes through the universe and finds our galaxy, then finds our solar system, then finds this little tiny thing called the earth, then finds a little creature raising their arms that they're going to overthrow the domain of God. You think we need to look at things from God's angle? This is how great God is. And so the psalmist and the prophet say, God shall have them at their leisure. They're utterly absurd thinking they can overthrow the domain of God. And man is so stupid because he's rebellious. If he recognized God, he would worship and humble himself before God. Oh, I say, are we happy that we're reconciled to a God like this? And how do you explain these migrations on a day-by-day basis? At a certain monastery out here in California, you have the swallows coming up the same day, March 19th, for 175 years. Except one day when they were a little bit late, and there was a very strong, a stormy headwind in which they had to fly in. Which proves that they started at the same time, rain or shine, atmosphere or no atmosphere. They start day by day. And what is it that causes this? You see, I think our God is trying to make it hard to be an unbeliever. This is why to be an unbeliever is an anti-believer. This is why it's easy to be a believer, it's hard to be an unbeliever. Because if you're a believer, you worship a God who can do all these things because he's great enough. If you're an unbeliever, you have no solution. Oh, if we think of the greatness of God, how precious to think of his love for us. What are you going to say about the fish life? How do you have the salmon moving out of its brook after a year or so and out into the ocean? Living in the ocean for maybe 6 years, not forgetting where it came from, or in some mysterious way coming back to where it came from. And this isn't an easy path. It jumps up over the rocks and struggles to get back to where it was. And then it dies as it puts forth its multitudes of new sources of life. What causes this? What causes the eels, for example, to hatch out in the brooks and rivers of Europe, swim across the ocean, live in the depths here, Bermuda, for a period of time and go back to where they came from. All these mysterious things. All the movings of the creatures without any end. Oh, I say we're in a mysterious world and how we should be thankful. How do you establish the butterfly, for example? Say you have a little source of life laid upon a nucleus. And pretty soon you'll have this caterpillar coming up to existence. After a couple of days, it begins to spin itself into an enclosure. There it lives for 12 days in its enclosure. Pretty soon, a new creature, the butterfly, pierces its way out, and out it comes. Exactly in the precise pattern of symmetry in its parents. It starts a long flight. That perhaps across half of our continent comes back in the next season, repeats the situation, knows what it is to find a milkweed. How do you have all these arrangements? How do you have the bees, for example, all the creatures pollinizing our different trees? And you have a whole picture of creation going along hand in hand. Oh my, do we see this remarkable structure that we're facing? And how do you account for the beautiful things God has given us to look at? Do you think God has a set of beauty? Do you think he's a lovely character? Think of the color schemes he's given us. Think of the arrangements he's given us. This tells us of his character, doesn't it? Think of the procedure. We don't think of a snowflake as very remarkable. But those that have studied them find they're six-sided. And that they're never any too alike. Why, there are millions and millions of snowflakes. Trillions of snowflakes. What kind of a being is God to make this diversity? How do you have a little drop of the water expand and explode into a snowflake? And take pains that it has a precision. Why, our concept of God is growing so big that we have to grow small. You see, if we want to get people to humble themselves, let's tell people what God is like. And then point such a picture of God that they're embarrassed to be proud. And see that they have nothing to be proud about. And what do we say about the whole reproduction system and the animal creation? Oh, how unthinkable are we confronted with the existences of life. Oh, I'm so grateful to have a God like this. Here then is the foundation of our guilt. Men are not going to be sent to hell for rejecting the gospel. Many haven't heard the gospel. This can't be the basis of guilt. The basis of guilt is to refuse to respond to the remarkable discovery that every moral being is faced with. Truly, it's a great sin to reject the gospel. And I viewed myself as a boy as 1,000 times more guilty than some friend of mine down the street who never heard of the gospel. So to reject the gospel is a terrifying thing and increases our guilt. But the basis of guilt is the recognition that there must be an offer of these remarkable things that we perceive and discover in our processes of observation. Heavenly Father, take some of these thoughts. Give us some concepts, we pray, by greatness. Increase our vision, Lord, of who thou art. Truly our hearts burn within us as we think of thy greatness, and thy Holy Spirit has come in our presence to live in some little way something of thy greatness. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.